This is day one of this February 2011 two-day sesshin, and I'm going to be reading from a book called Being Dharma, The Essence of the Buddha's Teachings, Ajahn Chah. It's translated by Paul Breiter. It's a foreword by Jack Kornfield. Ajahn Chah was one of a number of notable Thai and Burmese masters in the Theravadan school. Actually, the whole Insight Meditation Center comes from Ajahn Chah and people like him. Mahasi Sawada is another who was in Burma. Ajahn Chah was from Thailand. He was born in 1919 and he died in 1992. Somewhere I read that when he died, the king and queen of Thailand and a million people came to his funeral. So he was very well known in Southeast Asia, and we can see why. I want to read a little something that he wrote about his own difficulties with practice. He says, "Before I started to practice, I thought to myself, the Buddhist religion is here, available for all, yet why do only some people practice it while others don't? Or if they do practice, they do so for only a short while and then give it up. And those who don't give up still don't knuckle down and do the practice. Why is this?" Why indeed? Can each of us look at ourselves and ask, why don't I knuckle down? He said, "So I resolved to myself, okay, I'll give up body and mind for this lifetime and try to follow the teaching of the Buddha down to the last detail. I'll reach understanding in this lifetime, because if I don't, I'll still be sunk in suffering. I'll let go of everything else and make a determined effort. No matter how much difficulty or suffering I have to endure, I'll persevere. If I don't do it, I'll just keep on doubting." Thinking like this, I got down to practice. No matter how much difficulty I had to endure, I did it. I looked on my whole life as if it were only one day and a night. I gave it up. I'll follow the teaching of the Buddha. I'll follow the Dharma to understanding why this world is so wretched. I wanted to know. I wanted to see the truth. So I turned to the practice of Dharma. So much of our progress in practice is related to how seriously we take it, on what level we've made a commitment to do this simple, simple practice. When someone is committed on a level as deeply as Ajahn Chah, then the results are really quite remarkable. Sometimes strong motivation is slow in coming. Sometimes we need to try it our way for a while, sometimes for a long while, before the light dawns and we turn to practice. It doesn't have to be some sort of moralistic beating yourself up, just gritting your teeth, doing what you're supposed to do. This comes out of a real aspiration, this desire to know. Why are we here? What are we doing? And it comes out of a weariness with the ineffective ways that most people live, chasing after thoughts, chasing after what we like, pushing away what we don't like, trying to stage manage our lives so things will work out, continually watching out for ourselves, looking for other people to notice us. It's when you stand back and look at it, it's so colossally unskillful. You wonder why anyone would do it. But we do. We all do. Until we stop. So he says here, when a child from the city goes to the countryside for the first time, he'll see all kinds of things he hasn't seen before and doesn't know about. He will see a duck and ask, "Dad, what is that?" He sees a buffalo and cries out, "Mom, look at that big animal." He carries on like this over everything he sees until his parents are tired of answering. No matter what they explain, the child keeps on asking because he's never seen these things before and he's fascinated. Finally, they just grunt and reply. Ugh. The child doesn't get tired of it, though. "What's this? What's that thing? What could this animal be?" There's no end to his curiosity and his questions. But when he grows up, he will know all about these things, and they won't be a mystery to him anymore. It's like this in meditation. I used to be this way, too. But when real understanding came, the questions stopped. Through gaining some maturity and practice and inclining the mind toward investigation, one is able to resolve the questions by oneself. Every new experience seems so mind-boggling, so significant. We spend a tremendous amount of time thinking about our practice. Today was good, yesterday was bad. Doing everything except for practicing. It says you have to observe yourself constantly. Each of you has to look carefully to see how honest you are with yourselves and know when you are deceiving yourselves. Another word for deceiving oneself is being caught up in thought. If you're working, if you're following the breath, counting the breath, working on a koan, and you're toying with thoughts, automatically you're deceiving yourself. You think you're doing one thing, but you're doing another. He says, thinking is only a matter of conceptualization and creation. If we are not fully aware, we start to believe it is a matter of wisdom. So we follow after it and end up with dissatisfaction and suffering. If it were really wisdom, would it bring any suffering? He's especially speaking to Thai Buddhists here. There's a, I think, I get the impression that in Buddhism in Southeast Asia, there's a lot of emphasis on learning the dogma, on going through the eight worldly winds and the eightfold path and three characteristics of existence, all of which is extremely helpful, but that can become the entire focus of practice, just learning doctrine. If it were really wisdom, would it bring any suffering? For us, we may not be quite so doctrinal, but we are at least as stuck in our thoughts. thinking is a practical tool. It's a practical tool that we find ourselves unable to put down. It's kind of like my iPod. It's a wonderful device, and I find myself using it when I have absolutely no need to use it. I need to put it down. Just let it go. He says, even though it brings suffering, we hold on to it. Even though it brings suffering, it's painful to let go of our habitual thoughts. It's painful not to think. It's painful to drop thoughts when they come into the mind. We don't want to do it. You wonder why that is. Why when we can actually know peace and equanimity, we can get to a place that's clear and wonderful. All we need to do that, let alone break through, all we need to do to get into a samadhi-like state is stop dealing in thoughts. That's it. Believe me, try it. You won't fail to find yourself in a deeper place. But it's so hard to do. Basically, we're addicted. We're addicted to thinking. There are all sorts of habitual addictive patterns that don't really bring pleasure with them, and yet we still stick with them. People ask themselves, why do I constantly overeat? Why do I always end up with the same kind of guy? Why do I do this? Why do I do that? One explanation could be, well, you know, you have a karmic tendency to do that. It's just, it really comes down to that's what you've done, so you keep on doing it. You've worn the channels in your mind. You've got the grooves going. And there is this inertia that everybody has, and this resistance to change. What the Buddha called for is a dramatic change, a radical change. And all of us here in this room are trying to do that. Sesshin is a wonderful opportunity because we're not continually dragged back into the stream. At least we're not dragged back by outside influences. We have a little space. And we can find our way in. It may be that having found our way in, we suddenly find ourselves back out. But nevertheless, that in its own way is laying down a channel, laying down a path. It's extremely significant to let go of thoughts and to unify with the practice, with the breath or with the koan. This is a powerful, powerful engine of change. We have to see, we have to admit, we have to accept that practice can't be done with discursive thought. It's simpler than that. It's radically simple. We're called on to look directly. Look directly, not to be jumping around from this thought to that thought. Oh, mommy, what's that? We can do it. For a moment, it's not hard, just to turn. Why don't we keep it up? It's because we're continually looking past this moment. We're caught up in what comes next. Maybe we're thinking about results. Okay, I'm looking directly. Now what happens? No, you're not. You just took your eye off the ball. Really needs, something needs to be thrown away. Need to rest right here. Even when right here is confusion and pain, it's all grist for the mill. There's nothing we have to push away. There's nothing we have to get past to get to something better. We just need to stop trying to get away, stop scrambling, and rest here. Then things can begin to change. Nothing is going to stay the same. There's no condition that lasts. He says, thinking is only a matter of conceptualization and creation. If we're not fully aware, we start to believe it is a matter of wisdom. So we follow after it and end up with dissatisfaction and suffering. If it were really wisdom, would it bring any suffering? But then he says, still, this is something that can lead to wisdom, something that can cause us to see and to know. Don't get the idea they are far apart. Wherever conceptualization exists, wisdom is there. Wherever there is the created, the uncreated is there, is also there. The uncreated is freedom from conceptualization. The created is conceptualization. This is the same message as the great Chan master Huang Po. He says, if you monks would just get rid of conceptual thought. He says, this is pointed out through many different methods by different teachers. In Zen, for example, they have their ways for imparting wisdom. You are asked a question, and when you answer, they beat you. Bam! They ask again, so you don't answer this time, but they hit you again. What's really going on here? I might lose my life over this. How should I respond? What should I do? These methods can bring about wisdom. What to do? Going forward is not right. Retreating is not right. Standing still and giving no answer is not right either. Whatever you try, you only get a beating. Some feeling comes about and you start to seek more deeply for the answer. This is the method of Zen that I read about. It's curious, isn't it? It can really cause people to gain wisdom. However you answer or don't answer, you are beaten. You lose all your ideas about what is right and wrong. You can't move. You can't stand still. What do? You come to the end of your tether. But still there is something more to go through. So the mind keeps on investigating to find a way. Their methods are pretty good, I think. It's mysterious. We bang our head against the door again and again. And then somehow we're through. How does that happen? It's mysterious. He says, but ordinarily for us, it's just a lot of thinking and guessing about the way things are. We know something, but what we know is only what someone else has said. So there will always be more things to ask about and learn, and there are always more doubts. The more things are explained, the further we are from understanding. Why is it like this? What is blocking us? This knowledge itself is blocking us. All our intellectual knowledge, all our thinking, all our reliance on the tool of thought. It says, so you really need to search inwardly. What does that mean, to search inwardly? You really need to look directly. What is that? When you keep looking, He says, your understanding will become more subtle. This refined awareness will seem like something very good, but the Zen master won't accept it. Get rid of the subtle. I have no use for it. And you get another beating. When the subtle still remains, you have to drive it out. You don't know what to do or where to abide or to go, and you run out of options. It's better just to throw it all away. Don't go anywhere. It is taught that all of our thoughts and feelings are just the fantasy world of mental concoction. It is not real knowledge. It is the creation of fantasy, but we feel it is genuine knowledge. It is knowing without letting go. With real knowledge, one lets go. One begins to rely on letting go. It's in stressful situations, we always fall back on option A. And for most of us, option A isn't a very good one. But through practice, we begin to have faith in things as they are. When things get tough, we turn inward, we turn to our awareness. Of course, everyone has so much capacity. And everybody has that point at which they can't open up to experience. Almost everyone. Almost everyone has a point at which they shut down. But as we practice, our ability to just be present with everything, whether it's painful, physical pain, mental pain, anxiety, fear, our ability to be with those things widens. This is a wonderful thing. This is the nobility of a true practitioner. Not like a, what's the image that I think Hakuin uses, like a lobster in boiling water with its arms flailing. It says, with real knowledge, one lets go. He goes on, samadhi has its difficulties. People can get sidetracked. And then he quotes someone, when I sit, I have so many experiences. I see lights. I see colors. Dot, dot, dot. He says, they really get caught up in all this. When they tell me about their samadhi, there's not much I can say. It's just more childish stuff. It really is like the child fascinated by the animals and asking endless questions. That's what a child has to do because it doesn't know what things are. When it grows up, it will know for itself and won't have to ask anymore. In this most recent issue of Buddha Dharma, spring 2011, there's a little piece from Jack Kornfield actually talking about Ajahn Chah, speaking right to this point. I wanted to read it. He says, when I he practiced for a while with Ajahn Chah, and then he went to this other fellow, Mahasi Sayadaw, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, in Burma. And there he had some what we would probably call Kensho experiences, what he calls stream entry. He said, when I returned to practice in Ajahn Chah's community after more than a year of silent Mahasi retreat, I recounted my experiences. Dissolving my body into light, profound insights into emptiness, and hours of vast stillness and freedom. Ajahn Chah smiled and said, well, something else to let go of. His approach to enlightenment was not based on having any particular meditation experience, no matter how profound. As Ajahn Chah described them, meditative states are not important in themselves. Meditation is a way to quiet the mind so you can practice all day long wherever you are, see when there is grasping or aversion and so on, and then let it go. What's left is enlightenment, a release of identification with the changing conditions of the world, a resting in awareness, which is always found here and now. This involves a simple yet profound shift of identity from the myriad conditioned states to the unconditioned consciousness, the awareness that knows them all. In Ajahn Chah's approach, release from entanglement and greed, hatred, and delusion doesn't happen through a retreat, through concentration and cessation, but from this profound shift in identity. And this is the same spirit as Zen. Whatever you have, throw it out. It's past its expiration date. Stinks. I used to imagine that somehow I could finally have some experience where I'd be off the hook and could relax and coast. There's no relaxation in that sense. There is relaxing into effort, if we can put it that way. There's gratitude, there's willingness, but there's always effort. It goes on. Just look directly at what your state of mind is and abide with that awareness. That's all. You will have your foundation right there. With mindfulness and clear comprehension, knowing yourself in all four postures of standing, walking, sitting, and lying down, you are not grasping at whatever appears in your field of experience. When you are constantly aware of all that occurs, whether there is attraction or aversion, happiness or displeasure, doubt or certainty, there is investigating and knowing, getting the essence of practice, and experiencing the fruit. Don't go fixating on the way things appear to be. This is what's so helpful about a breath practice or working on a koan. We have a place to put our attention. We don't have to fixate on our thoughts. The breath or the koan is not anything fixed. It's not an object. Recognize whatever appears to the mind as merely so, merely a moment of sensation and awareness, something impermanent that arises and passes away. There is nothing more than that. There is no self or other, no essence, nothing that should be grasped. This is very reminiscent of a teaching of a Zen teacher named Kosho Uchiyama. He's a Soto teacher in Japan, or was. Wrote a book called Opening the Hand of Thought. This is really what no grasping is. He explains, he has a really brief explanation that I wanted to read because it fits so well with this. He says, briefly, aiming at maintaining the posture of Zazen with our flesh and bones, letting go of thoughts, is the most appropriate expression for describing what our attitude should be. What is letting go of thoughts? Well, when we think of something. Thinking of something means grasping that something with thought. However, during Zazen, we open the hand of thought that is trying to grasp something and simply refrain from grasping. This is letting go of thoughts. Letting go of feelings. Letting go of sensations. Simply refrain from picking it up. And when we do find, as we will, that we've picked it up, then our first response is to let go. It's not to start running a commentary on that, adding more trouble to the trouble we're already in. There isn't any need to think, oh, damn it, look at that. God, I can't maintain this for more than 2 seconds. I'm pathetic. If that kind of beating oneself up were effective, it would be recommended. It's like trying to harass a child into behaving correctly. It just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. We need to step back enough to see what we're doing that's ineffectual. We're here. We can change how we work. We can learn. We're teachable, all of us. Just need to let go of our addiction to unskillful means. Let go of our grasping. May have to do it many, many times. But so what? Do we have something better to do? If we do, then go do it. He says, when body and mind are seen thus with wisdom, we are aware of all the old habits and patterns. That is, aware without judgment. Seeing the impermanence of body and mind, seeing the impermanence of the totality of all feelings of happiness and suffering, of love and hate, we realize there is only so much to them. They are merely what they are, and the mind turns. It turns away and becomes weary of it all. It becomes weary of mind and body, these things that appear and pass away and are unreliable. Wherever we may be, we see this. When the mind becomes weary, its only concern will be to find a way out. We no longer want to live as before because we see the imperfections and liabilities of the worldly way. I want to be careful here not to think that there is some spiritual way that stands in opposition to this worldly way, that now we're going to do that and everything's going to be great. Plenty of people who get caught up in spiritual progress, getting through their koans or having a position of authority or being looked up to by others, getting the approval of their teacher. This is all just more of the worldly way. There's nothing spiritual about this. What goes against the worldly way is letting go, refraining from grasping. Realizing that we are where we need to be. Just don't check out. It says, we see the liability of this life we have been born into. With this perspective, wherever we go, we will see the facts of the impermanent, unsatisfactory and selfless nature of phenomenon, and there will be nothing we wish to get or grasp hold of. So these three characteristics of phenomenon, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, selflessness. This is the basic teaching of the Buddha. All phenomenon have these three characteristics. None of them are permanent. Nothing will fail to change. It's nothing fixed, including, of course, our so-called ego. And inevitably, if we pursue them, we run into suffering. They're inherently unsatisfactory. They're not what we're looking for. There is no thing that's what we're looking for. Nothing can bring us pleasure, permanent pleasure. And they have no self. There is no self. Basic characteristic of existence. There's no entity. Even though we act and talk and think and dream as if there were a little person somewhere, we've never seen that little person. We never will. It doesn't exist. Over time, sincerely practicing, these characteristics become self-evident. We begin to get it, begin to see it. And as he says, this is a tremendous motivation to go further. We realize that new job, perfect house, perfect wife, perfect kids, none of those things are going to do it. They're all going to change. They're all going to slip away. It says there will be nothing we wish to get or grasp hold of. Sitting beneath a tree, we hear the teaching of the Buddha. Sitting atop a mountain, we hear the teaching of the Buddha. Sitting on a plain, we hear the teaching of the Buddha. We will see this world much more clearly. We will see body and mind more clearly. The realms of form and formlessness we will see more clearly. They become clearer in the light of impermanence, in the light of the unsatisfactory nature of things, in the light of the absence of a self. Whenever we humans hold on to things as being permanent and real, suffering comes immediately. But when we realize the truth of body and mind, suffering is not born. Without attachment, there is no way for suffering to take hold. In all situations, wisdom will arise. Even seeing a tree, wisdom arises through this contemplation. Seeing plants in the fields, seeing insects, wisdom arises. They all end up at the same point to become Dharma, the point of not being certain, or we could say not being fixed. This is the truth. They are things that are not permanent. In what way are they permanent? The only permanence or certainty is that having arisen, they are transitory and unreliable. They cannot change into something that will not undergo transformation and then cease to be. That's all. If you truly realize this, you have traveled your path to the end. This is quite a statement. Because we hear this, okay, three characteristics of existence. Yeah, got that. That's traveling your path to the end. But here again, we're dealing with intellectual knowledge. If you see, then the desire to grasp at things drops away. You're not fooled, you're not deceived. I think this is a good place to stop, so we'll stop now and recite the four vows.